It's late October in Glasgow, Scotland, the site of the 2015 World Artistic Gymnastics Championship. After a week of competition, the women's gymnastics field had reached the final event, the individual floor exercise, and the final competitor, the 4'8", 75-pound gymnast from China, Shang Chunsong. Shang would perform exceptionally.
Well, do not be fooled by the tiny Chinese gymnast, Shang Chunsong, here. She is powerful and energetic and incredibly impressive on this floor exercise. So, here we go. 2.5 full. Impressive start. Now, watch this. This is something a little bit special. 1.5 into triple twist and then punch front. And she makes it look effortless. Whizzes round in those spins. Into the third. It's a half twist out of the 2.5 twist. Great elevation there on the ring. Now she needs a straight tumble pass, and there it is. Double pike to finish. Well, that was an action-packed, technically incredibly difficult routine.
The international panel of judges would award her routine a score of 14.933, putting her in fourth place, just 0.067 points short of a medal. I should say, Shang finished fourth again. Just 2 days earlier, she had finished fourth in the all-around competition as well, also falling short of a medal by less than a point. Fourth place would become a familiar position for the gymnast. Over the course of her career, Shang would finish in fourth place 3 times at international competitions. She would never win an individual medal at the Worlds or the Olympics. She was, effectively, the first loser off the podium. However, just as it is easy to underestimate Shang on the basis of her slight stature, it's likewise easy to underestimate the magnitude of her accomplishments. Shang faced numerous barriers in her early life, including mountains, money, and malnourishment. She endured the rigorous state-run Chinese athletics training apparatus, a system which often seeks wins for China in exchange for losses to the well-being of athletes. Where Shang may lose in the medal count, she wins in perseverance and sheer strength of will.
History is written by the victors. Or is it?
Welcome to Lost and Found, where we challenge the idea that only winners write history by highlighting the past's most impressive losers. This week, we bravely foray into the world of sports to tell the story of Chinese gymnast Shang Chunsong. Before that, though, I think we should try to pin down what exactly we mean by losing in this context. What does it mean to lose in, say, Olympic competition, or in any competition where medals are awarded to the top 3 finishers? Well, of course, we might say that, save for the gold medalist, everyone loses. Or we could say that anyone who doesn't get a medal loses. Before today, we're going to focus on what might be the most painful losing position of all. Fourth place, just off the podium. Now, there's a body of academic research on Olympic athletes which finds that competitors who win silver are, on average, less satisfied with their result than competitors who win bronze. Why might that be the case? Well, it seems that us human beings don't really define our accomplishments in absolute terms. We define them relatively, with respect to the accomplishments of others. So, athletes who get silver feel bad because they just missed first place. Athletes who get bronze feel better because they narrowly avoided being left out. By extension, it would seem that fourth place is uniquely the most gut-wrenching place to finish of any near the top. An athlete who finishes fifth, for example, would be happy to finish in the top five, but an athlete who finishes fourth is left with the bitter taste of being one step off the podium. Of all the potential ways to lose in medal-dealing competitions, fourth place is foremost in terms of heartbreak. Which is why, of course, Shang Chunsong's story merits attention in a show about, well, losing. In artistic gymnastics, there are two recurring competitions which are perceived as the most important of all, where the stakes of winning and losing are highest. First, the Olympics every 4 years, and second, the World Championships, held annually in each intervening non-Olympic year. These two competitions, more than any other, attract the greatest concentration of elite talent from the broadest geographical area. Winning a medal at either the Olympics or the World Championships is the ultimate goal of an artistic gymnast, and likewise, a fourth place in either of these competitions is the most heartbreaking version of an already heartbreaking position. Shang finished in fourth place three times across these two preeminent competitions, twice at the 2015 World Championships in Glasgow, and once at the 2016 Summer Olympics in Rio. And, even more gloomily, she would never win an individual medal in either competition across her entire career. She's the only gymnast to ever finish in fourth place at least three times and also never win a major individual medal. Since this is a show about losing, we might as well twist the knife a bit further. We've already said that Shang finished in the most painful position of all, at the competitions where the pain of painful positions is most acute, and did it three times without ever doing better. But beyond that, two of her fourth place finishes came in the all-around competition, broadly considered to be the premier event in gymnastics, the event where winning a medal is most prized, and losing is most painful. Shang is also the only gymnast to ever finish in fourth place 2 years in a row in the all-around. But, as promised, this is far from her whole story. Let's put her fourth place finishes in context of her background. Shang was born into poverty in northern Hunan, a mountainous province in central China. Malnourishment from a young age most likely stunted her growth, contributing to her 4'8", 75-pound frame, her struggle to gain muscle, and her frequent illness during her competitive career. Her parents both worked in construction, and they struggled to pay for necessities like heating, water, and transportation. When she was 6 years old, she and her 12-year-old brother had to walk a precarious, multi-mile mountain path to reach school each day. Her brother had a congenital vision disease, which made so that he could see very little at night. In the morning, he would carry Shang to school on his back, but at night, 6-year-old Shang would have to guide him back across the mountain many miles to return home. A year later, she would enter the state-run gymnastics training apparatus, with the express intent of providing for her family. She hoped to earn a salary from the government by successfully advancing through the ranks of the system, and eventually use the money to buy a home for her brother and to pay for his medical treatment. Her brother, in his memoir, recalls a conversation with Shang, in which she told him she would, quote, strive for the very best in gymnastics so that you and the family can live a life of prosperity and wealth. I think it's important to remember here that this is a 7-year-old girl saying these things. From her mountain maneuvers a year earlier, to her choice to endure rigorous training in pursuit of familial stability, Shang displayed a remarkable degree of selflessness and integrity at an age where most of us were still learning to write our names and tell circles from squares. And Shang would eventually achieve her goals for her family, at least in part. When she developed her gymnastics enough to reach the second tier of the training system, she started to receive a government salary. From the start, she was intensely frugal. She refused to buy herself new athletic wear, as her fellow trainees did frequently, even as her clothes deteriorated. She committed to this conservation strategy, even as she developed yearly illnesses in the winter, possibly as a consequence of a compromised immune system from her malnutrition. At age 17, just 10 years after beginning her gymnastics training, Shang would succeed in purchasing a home for her family. 2 years later, she would finish fourth in two separate events at the Glasgow World Championships. And I should mention that she did surpass fourth place in the team competition. She and her compatriots would take silver in Glasgow and bronze in Beijing the following year. So put in context, she came from having to evade cliff edges in the dark just to attend school to being the fourth best all-around female gymnast in the world. She took her family from abject poverty to a stable livelihood in a decade. Shang's story evokes what I think will become something of a theme on this show, that losing is seldom objective and rarely static. One person's idea of losing is another's idea of victory, and a loss in 1 year might be perceived as a win in another. At this point in the show, I think it's necessary to speak about Chinese elite sports more broadly in order to further contextualize Shang's story. You see, Shang's tale, although remarkable, is not entirely unique. Indeed, a number of Chinese youth enter China's elite training apparatus each year, seeking financial gains and perhaps glory for China. Many leave with neither. Most leave with far less than Shang. In China, the elite training system functions primarily as a government political lever, which deprioritizes the well-being and individuality of athletes, using them as implements towards a larger political goal of nation-building, either fostering nationalism domestically or enhancing China's international image. In addition to physical and emotional harms incurred during the competitive years, the system fails to provide adequate employment, education, and welfare support for athletes in retirement, leaving a large proportion of retired athletes unemployed or impoverished. The training apparatus generates wins for China and losses for the well-being of individual athletes. China's elite sports training apparatus stands as a remnant of the era of Soviet-advised government structuring in China. The multi-tiered, regimented system exists primarily to engineer success for China in elite competition on an international stage. The Chinese Communist Party, or CCP, established the Ministry of Sport in 1952, enticed by Soviet victories and subsequent international renown in the 1952 Helsinki Olympics. The elite training apparatus, born in 1953, modeled the centralized USSR sports award pyramid. The elite training program was initially developed equally with quote-unquote mass sports, sports for leisure and fitness. However, in 1980, Sports Minister Wang Meng recognized international sports excellence as an opportunity to legitimize China's economic reforms. The central government's subsequent divestment from mass sport and prioritization of elite competition was confirmed in the Sports Ministry's 1985 Olympic strategy, which explicitly specified international elite competition as the national goal of sport. The pyramidic training system, formalized in the 1980s, persists as the primary avenue to elite competition for Chinese athletes today. The elite training apparatus contains three levels. Sports schools, the primary level, provincial professional sports teams, the intermediate level, and the national team, the elite level. Prospective athletes enter the pyramid at a young age, often as early as age 4, often hand-selected by scouts for a particular sport. Records from the 2000s and 2010s indicate that over 370,000 young athletes, the primary level, 45,000 professional athletes, the intermediate level, and 3,000 national team members populate their respective levels in a given year. The early age of entry and pipeline structure of the pyramid imply its purpose. to manufacture athletes primed to procure glory for China at the international level. Indeed, the system's status as a gold medal producing machine has been affirmed at high levels of government. Sports Minister Yuan Weimin put starkly in 2001 that the system functioned to channel, quote, financial and human resources in order to win Olympic medals for the nation. Now, it might seem perfectly in order for a sports training system to seek victory. The question becomes, at what cost? Unfortunately, the system's hyper-focus on medals brings about a lack of focus on the humans that win them. The program's attempt to, quote, drive human resources towards Olympic victory often treats athletes as just that, resources, implements within a broader nation-building agenda. The system harms the athlete in three main ways. The first is physical or psychological harms. Despite recent gravitations towards more scientific or physiologically informed training methods, training and coaching still revolve around the tenets of the three unafraids, unafraid of hardship, difficulty, and injury, and the five toughnesses, toughness of spirit, body, skill, training, and competition, fostering an environment which openly condones corporal punishment and verbal abuse. Such practices, combined with the physical strain of training itself, increases injury risk substantially. Research suggests that in certain sports such as wrestling, more than 90% of athletes sustain major in-training injuries. Likewise, the risk of post-career health complications is augmented for athletes, with data from multiple regions indicating an enhanced risk of heart disease among retired athletes. The system places undue burdens on the mental health of athletes as well. In addition to the obvious psychological strain brought about by physical injury, young athletes in training often have to relocate hundreds of miles from home to attend sports schools, perhaps only seeing their families 1 to 2 times per year. The second harm is diversion of income. Elite athletes who advance through the pyramid and compete through the national team are obligated to surrender a substantial proportion of their monetary winnings to central and provincial governments. Although the amount varies by sport and the degree of commercialization within respective professional leagues, even the highest level athletes can divert as much as 65% of their winnings to the government. For example, Chinese tennis star Li Na, the first Chinese tennis player male or female to ever win a Grand Slam, was required to give 65% of her prize money to the government as a member of the Chinese national team. After making the decision to compete independently from the national team, a path only available to athletes with the financial stability to pay for travel and accommodation, she was only required to divert 12% of her winnings. Additionally, the government exercises control over an athlete's potentially lucrative endorsements, for example, by selling an athlete's image rights without their consent, thereby requisitioning potential endorsement income. The third, and arguably most substantial harm, is a lack of education. At primary-level sports schools, athletes study for approximately half the hours of students in parallel non-sports schools. Some schools also limit subject offerings by providing, for example, Chinese and math alone, forgoing a more comprehensive slate of sciences and humanities. At the intermediate level, education opportunities grow even more scarce. In certain provinces, greater than 80% of athletes study only 1 to 2 hours per day. Of those who do attend class regularly, subject offerings are limited, lessons truncated, and the setting is informal. At the highest level, education is by and large forgone entirely. Such a system ultimately leaves athletes ill-prepared for life after competition. Although statistics vary, research comprehensively concludes that retired athletes are undereducated. Some data suggests that, of all retired athletes, greater than 60% have a high school equivalent education or less. Other research indicates that, of all athletes, 46% conclude their education at the level merely compulsory under the law, equivalent to a middle school education in the U.S. Given the quality of this education, it's likely that they never genuinely reach this compulsory level. As such, a training system which already only vaults a few athletes to renown stunts the education of all of them. These substantial human costs expose the training system as one which devalues the individual in the name of national pride and international image. More specifically, the central government utilizes the nationalistic overtones of elite sport as a policy tool to maintain internal stability vis-a-vis external and internal criticism. For example, prior to the 2008 Beijing Olympics, international protests of the Olympic torch relay arose in response to China's human rights record, particularly the crackdown on Tibetan unrest earlier that year. Chinese leaders figured the international response as a nefarious Sinophobic conspiracy, encouraging feelings of public solidarity against the purportedly biased Western media. The events of the 2008 Beijing Games exemplified the use of sports as a medium through which the center posits China against the world, thereby building national unity and diverting attention from domestic protests, and, more holistically, pacifying the public in response to rising land, labor, and capital costs in a liberalizing Chinese economy. It seems that, at least in certain instances, Chinese citizens have internalized the prospect of glory for the country as a justifiable exchange for harms to themselves. Retired world gymnast Fan Ye starkly articulated in 2012 that she felt no regret in relinquishing her childhood to become, in her words, state property. However, not all athletes feel so comfortable exchanging respect for their individual personhood for glory in the country's name. Shen Jian, a Chinese BMX athlete, characterizes the government's management of sports as, quote, exploitation. Clearly, the conditions for elite Chinese athletes during their competitive careers is not ideal. However, the particular structure of the system also renders athletes inadequately prepared for life after competition. Persistent injuries, lack of saved income, and most importantly, undereducation, make the task of finding stable employment extremely challenging. A scattered history of government reform efforts have proved insufficient to substantively improve the situation. The history of government support for retired athletes can be broadly divided into three time periods: the mandatory period, pre-1986, the transitional period, from 1987 to 2001, and the marketing period, from 2002 to more or less the present day. In the mandatory period, the first period, the center largely secured post-career employment for athletes. In the command economy, the government effectively controlled enterprises in the labor market, and as such, government policy established hiring quotas for individual enterprises, and many athletes received lifelong labor contracts. Under this system, approximately 80% of athletes were re-employed soon after retirement, and a substantial proportion of those not immediately employed pursued higher education. So, in short, stability for retired athletes was largely provided by the government. However, entering the transitional period, as the Chinese economy liberalized, government officials sought to reaffirm their commitment to this liberalization. Officials began to encourage athletes to find jobs on their own in the competitive marketplace, although no formal, universalized policy was adopted. Understandably, in this environment, retired athlete unemployment rose. In some regions, the proportion of athletes awaiting re-employment rose above 90%. In 2002, marking the beginning of the third period, the center formally committed to its policy of encouraging retired athletes to find their own employment. It incentivized this practice by offering a one-time settlement allowance to those athletes who chose to seek work in the labor market. At the same time as this policy, the Ministry of Sport issued a recommendation which urged provincial-level governments to enhance retired athletes' access to education, vocational skill training, and employment. However, no formal mandate ensured education or vocational training. In 2007, the central government expanded support for retired athletes through a variety of social safety net programs, including life insurance and injury or disability insurance. This threefold policy approach, 1, the one-time settlement allowances, 2, encouragement of provincial governments to provide educational or vocational support, and 3, the social safety net, largely persists today. Despite localized successes, for the majority of retired athletes, government efforts have proved insufficient. Reports from national and regional publications suggested in 2016 that approximately 80% of the population of retired athletes suffer from injury, unemployment, or poverty. Reports in 2012 indicated that, of the 3,000 athletes that retire each year, only one-third find proper job placement. As such, the unemployment rate for retired athletes may be as high as 40%. Why haven't the policy measures worked? The most important reason, I think, is that governments at all levels have failed to provide adequate educational support. Although some regions have implemented policies to help advance athletes beyond the meager education provided within the training system, opportunities have been granted neither across all regions nor to all athletes within regions. Some provinces have offered free entry, without taking exams, into university, but only for those athletes who attain high placements at international competitions. For less accomplished athletes, passing university exams may be difficult given the lack of prior education, and inadequate education is a substantial barrier to adequate employment. Even for those athletes who do find work, many are underemployed, working low-wage, part-time, or temporary jobs. Retired athletes lack the requisite education and skills to compete for stable employment in a market economy. There are a number of other reasons why current policies fail to support retired athletes. But I think the point I started with is clear. The Chinese elite training system seeks wins for China in exchange for losses to the well-being of individual athletes. So, what was the point of that long tangent away from the story about an individual gymnast which started this episode? First, I think it makes Shang Chunsong's story even more remarkable. When she entered a system which would wear down anybody, she was already physically challenged by poverty, saddled with more life experience than the average person 3 times her age, and was carrying her family's future on her back, just like her brother carried her to school when they were young. And she nonetheless emerged from the training apparatus as one of the foremost well-rounded female gymnasts in the world, and procured financial stability for her family. The pressures of the training system, on top of the already difficult circumstances of her early life, should prompt us to think of her fourth-place finishes as anything but losses. But the flaws of the training apparatus should also remind us that losses can be systemic, which is another theme that will most likely reappear on this show. Certain systems have a tendency to produce losers, and some are intentionally constructed to do so. In the coming weeks on this show, we will undoubtedly be looking at some of those systems and the inspiring stories of the losers within them.
Here at Lost and Found, we, meaning me, Marcus, writer and host, have lots of homework. And as much as I like talking about losing, I don't like feeling like a loser in class. So, the narrative form of the show each week is generally less than an hour, with the rest of the time filled with creative but less, research-intensive content. This week, I explore a few pieces of classical music thematically related to this week's episode about Shang Chunsong and the Chinese gymnastics training system. The following are the third and fourth movements from Tchaikovsky's Sixth Symphony. In line with one of the themes from today's show, that some systems tend to produce losers, Tchaikovsky's Sixth seems to end triumphantly with stately, almost nationalistic overtones. It seems to end that way, until you remember that there's one movement left to go. Tchaikovsky diverges from the traditional symphony structure, concluding with the morose fourth movement. Some allegations say that Soviet orchestras would flip the third and fourth movements in order to end more triumphantly. The two movements taken together paint a picture of murmurs, chaos, and sadness within a system intended to be rigidly structured.
Thank you.
The last piece for today, the second movement from Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony, evokes similar feelings as the Tchaikovsky, uncertainty and angst within a structured system. It most likely reflects Shostakovich's disillusionment with life as a composer in the USSR, as he was often subject to persecution and censorship of his work due to its perceived political content, a mode of rebellion.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in next week. Until then, keep losing. It builds character.